This is an I Am Listening exclusive podcast.
All the greatest men and women throughout history have been as hated in their time as they were revered. You know, it's the best that anyone can say about you is you're lovely. Then you're failing.
You're listening to Jeans and an Ice Top, your go-to podcast when it comes to navigating adulting and the big life stuff. With me, Chels. With no guidebook, most of us are fumbling through life, trying to remember to take the bins out, with no real idea what we want to do career-wise, what on earth love is, and did anyone mention taxes? Through some oversharing, way too many cups of coffee, and some little nuggets of advice, I hope to make the existential crisis that bit more bearable by reminding you that you're not alone. And sometimes, it's about focusing on the things we can control and keeping things simple, like jeans and a nice top.
Hey team, and welcome to another episode of Jeans and a Nice Top podcast. And this episode features the final male of the season, the one and only Neil Smedley, better known as co-founder of King Kobe Barbers. This episode was a real favourite of mine as me and Neil both went into debate on really big topics such as toxic masculinity, censorship, the importance of finding your truth and knowing who you are in modern day society, dissecting Mormonism, and the importance of having the confidence to be disliked. I really enjoyed this episode because I find that bringing people together from very different trajectories of life always brings with it really interesting debate, in which you're exposed to new ways of thought and left questioning how diversified your perspective truly is, and actually to reassess what you accept as truth. Neil is an incredibly articulate public speaker who not only inspired me to be confident in my own self-discovery, but also acted as a reminder to always question and stay curious rather than follow the crowd, which I think with everything going on in the media currently is more important than ever. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did and was left with a ton of questions in your brain. As always, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. Follow me on Instagram at smiletohealth. And if you like poetry, check out my book on Amazon, Curse to Feel. Ciao! Hey team, and welcome to another episode of Jeans and a Nice Top podcast. And this week, we are blessed with the one and only Neil Smedley, aka King Kobe Official on Instagram. He is one of the founders of King Kobe Barbershop, brand spanning numerous locations in the northeast of the UK. He's a thought leader on men's mental health and has worked within the mental health sector, making real pivotal change and not being afraid to share his opinion, which I think in today's society is more important than ever, essentially around articulating yourself, putting your opinion out there without being fearful of censorship or anyone putting you down for your opinion, because I think the power of voice and the power of spoken word is what's our one true gift. But for those who don't know you, tell us who you are and what you do.
Well, you summed up my immediacy at least. So yeah, so I just turned 41 on Saturday. So
happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
How do you feel about it?
I don't know. When I turned 40, I was really concerned. Like, it made me really depressed. Now I'm past that, so I'm not really working on 42.
You've like passed the threshold.
Okay, more. But so I'm based in Leeds now. I've been in Leeds for 15 years, but I'm not from Leeds originally. I'm from Scarborough.
Yeah.
Like a small coastal town, 67 miles away from here. So I spent all of my working life before I started King Kobe working in mental health settings and with children. So my very first job was working in a children's hall, which was for boys only, 12 to 16. And they sent them basically before they went kind of into the prison system. So we had this set period of time to try and mold them and change them and encourage them, etc. And then I loved it. Like, it was the happiest I've ever been. And I was 20 when I got that job. So I had no right to get...
So, you're young yourself.
The oldest kids there were 16. So, I mean, technically, we were so close in age for them to see me as an authority figure, which you need in that setting, wasn't there. So yeah, I had no right at all to get that job, but did, and just loved it. It was the only thing I've done that never felt like work.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was making like 30 and a half grand or something like that. But it was, I was happy doing that. And then I moved from there to work for Camden in NHS. The child and adolescent health team, which was really intense. So we have a caseload of between 30 and 40 clients.
Yeah.
And they would range from anything from eating disorders to depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, just the whole gamut of kind of mental health issues.
Yeah.
And then I moved from that into training. So as much as I loved doing what I was doing, and I did, I definitely felt a call and a purpose to it. The reality is that in the public sector, you don't make any money.
No, it's It's such a shame because it's such a thankless task, because it's, I don't think it's a job everyone can do, because the emotional load and weight that you have to carry in order to be able to provide for these people that aren't emotionally stable and need that emotional support as well as like the physical support.
Yeah.
And then to not be paid a good wage to do it is that it's a lot. So I have a lot of respect.
The guys that I work with were just, I mean, some of them emotionally speaking were just geniuses, you know?
Yeah.
They were able to literally, you know, change family's life and change the life of these kids who were working with. You know, and they were making £23,000-£24,000 a year and topping out at that. And these are people that had been at university for 3 or 4 years, the master's degrees, they were very educated people. So I realized kind of quickly that as much as I love doing what I'm doing and I do for a calling and a passion for it, there's no money to be made here. So
you've got a bigger vision.
Not that thing between, okay, I have this calling and this passion and I feel this sense of duty to be of service, if you like. But I also kind of want to make some money. So I moved from that into training kind of police and probation services on how to deal with young people with mental health. Really enjoyed the training and the public speaking side of things. And then moved from there into training corporates. So I worked with Vodafone for a couple of years and turned soft skills to their managers, which I hated it. And then
I find if you're very creative as well, the corporate world is just so difficult. It's quite stifling and it's very grey is the only way.
It's very vague and it's very kind of pointless. Yeah. It's like, as much as I enjoy the delivering content, I mean, one, the content wasn't mine, it was given to me to deliver. So no matter how articulate you deliver something, my job was essentially to teach people how to be manipulative and how to make more money.
Which is the polar opposite to what you were doing before, which was teaching people to connect to themselves.
It didn't sit right with me at all, even though my money was sort of 15 grand more than I was making before in a company car. And I was still young. I was still sort of, you know, 25, 26 then. So, you know, my head went maybe a little bit by those things. But then I was made redundant and I started what is now Kinkobi with my brother. So we were called iMail to begin with. So to begin with, it wasn't meant to be a barbershop at all. Yeah. We were meant to be like a cosmetics brand, basically, for guys. Mm-hmm. You know, like Space NK. It was meant to be that, but just for guys.
Yeah. So like a premium cosmetics brand. Because there's not actually that many. I mean, you've got Kiehl's and what's it, Malin and Goats. But apart from that, and it's quite specific and very clinical, there isn't a lot that's kind of trendy and premium.
No, exactly. So we kind of went down that route and it didn't work. It didn't work at all. I mean, we'd found some places in London where they were really successful. I mean, the culture in the North, especially in terms of masculinity. So it was probably an idea that was a bit ahead of its time. And we were really naive. I mean, we started that business with like £5,000. You know, we honestly believed that all we had to do was open up and customers would come in. Like we had no cash flow, we had nothing. So we got to about 9 months in, and we had 3 months left in the bank. And we knew we were done, that we were going to go back. Yeah. And we had 3 months money left, so we were just kind of ticking down the clock. And then one day, completely out of the blue, this 17-year-old kid walks into the shop. He just qualified as a barber and asked us if we had any jobs going for barbering. At the first, because like, we're not a barber shop. It was a bizarre question. Yeah. But I kind of liked him. And, you know, he had some...
Yeah, ballsy.
Yeah, he was ballsy. And he had some tattoos. And by the same guy that tattooed me. So we put this kind of a pull up. I took his CV off him on just to be polite. I didn't give it a second thought. For whatever reason, that night when I got home, I was like, we're done anyway. Like, we're done.
Yeah.
So, like, fuck it. Why not? We've got 3 months left. 3 months capital left. Let's buy a barber chair. Let's put him in the basement. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
And kind of to cut a long story short, that's now led to 3 shops, 2 bars, a clothing range, 32 members of staff. And this is our 10th year.
You hit the decade.
It was a happy accident. It wasn't just hard work. It was a really happy accident.
Yeah. But then I guess you like undersell yourself in that sense, because the hard work through the process and the skill sets that you learn, you know, doing the jobs where you didn't get paid a lot of money, going into different spaces, being surrounded by the different types of people as well. Because I can imagine, you know, the people that you were finding in your like NHS sector was very different to the corporate world in the suits and the JAG life, basically. Yeah. And that gave you the ability to kind of appeal to a broader network.
Yeah, I think so. Like I've always been comfortable. I mean, because I was raised Mormon, so I was raised very religious. And within Mormonism, for those that don't know, it isn't just a religion, it's an entire lifestyle, it's a culture, it governs every facet of life. So within that, from a very young age, you're exposed to people from all walks of life, literally from you know, people on benefits to millionaires and everybody in between. So you kind of get used to, you know, to how you communicate effectively with people across the spectrum. So that served me well, but I didn't have a clue what I was doing in business.
Yeah.
Like I didn't have
a clue. You're not taught it at school though, are you? There's no education on how to actually successfully start a business plan. The logistics side of things, I think, is really complicated.
I had no idea at all. I mean, in truth, and this isn't affecting modesty, I still don't. Like it still amazes me here. Because this is, I mean, if you speak to the guys that work for me, they'll tell you how fucking useless I am at certain things. So
but you pay other people to do it. That's the point.
Yeah, I surround myself with, I'm good at recognizing what I'm not at and getting people on board for that. But in the early days, so we started off with one kid, Sandy, who became a really, really close friend of mine. And then it just grew and grew and grew. And I mean, we didn't make money straight away. We made just enough money to kind of keep the lights on. But at that point, I was like, I don't ever want to work for somebody again. I don't ever want to work for somebody ever again. Now I've sentenced this freedom. So the plan was always to make as much money as I possibly could and then go back into working with kids and psychotherapy, but to be able to do it on my terms and not because I needed a paycheck.
Which I think is the constant battle, isn't it? I know definitely as a creative personally, I'm in that constant push and pull of wanting to earn money and have a life and support the lifestyle that I want. And then wanting to be a creative, which doesn't always provide that, working for myself, having more of a free life.
Yeah, when we started the business, because I'm not now, but then I was far more liberal than I am now. Not that I'm conservative now, but I was naively liberal. And I considered myself a socialist. So money wasn't important to me. Yeah. And I ran the business as if money wasn't important to me. Which looking back now was so naive. Like it's so naive. You
know? Makes the world go round.
Yeah, it does, you know. And you know, the reality is that we need money and money makes your life easier. You know, money's not the be all end all, but the reality is that 85-90% of most people's problems in life would be solved if they had more money, you know.
Yeah,
it's a sad thing, but that's the way it is in the West, you know. The more money you have, the your life is. Or at least when tragedy comes to you, you've got better resources to deal with it. So I had to really change my mindset and become kind of trying to find a way where I could operate in this middle ground where I wasn't going full out kind of Gordon Gekko, which isn't in my character, but I was also not being naive to the fact that, you know, hey, money doesn't matter, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
Would you say that the naivety was because of your age, or was it also because of the way you were brought up within the Mormon society? I'd actually love to dissect that a bit more, because obviously a lot of us, like for me, like for example, I've never known anyone that's Mormon. I've been exposed to people from different religions, but like you said, Mormon is a lifestyle. And what you normally see in a film is 1920s America, where it's like an isolated estate where they don't mingle with society. And I feel like your experience was very different.
Everyone's got 10 wives. I'm fourth, fifth generation Mormon. So grandparents, aunties, uncles, everybody in my family is Mormon. So that had a huge impact on how we thought socially as well.
Yeah.
You know, because everything was about trying to, you know, replicate the life of Christ, and what money was an object to that. And you couldn't chase God and Mammon at the same time. You know, I bought into all that. Not that those things are bad things, but they're not deep enough, you know, to drop right in the world. So yeah, no, it wasn't my age. I mean, I believed in those things sincerely. I really do. Really did, rather. But when I look back now, I do question what my motives actually were.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of what we do subconsciously is a virtue signal, you know? Yeah. So to try to accumulate wealth. And this is the thing. You can I want to be rich. I'm ashamed of it. But I want to be rich for the right reasons. I want to be rich because I want to buy my freedom back.
Yeah.
Like, you will never see me not dressed in shit clothes. You will never see me drive a Ferrari. You will never see me live in a mansion, no matter how much money I have.
Yeah.
What I really want money for is to wake up with my son and a daughter on a Monday morning and say, what do you want to do today? Rather than I'll see you at 6 o'clock. So
yeah, because your whole day is...
Yeah. So my motivation for accumulating wealth is to buy my freedom back. And I think that a lot of the people that look down upon that, I include myself in this, I think it's deeply unconscious, so I'm not passing it to anybody, is that when you set an aim for something and you don't achieve it, when you set, then you've given yourself a place for failure. So it's easier. You see this all the time, don't you? You know, a guy drives past in a Porsche or a Lamborghini, you know, and all the guys like, that wanker.
Yeah. Because it's easier. It's easier to hate the person for it because I always see it as a significance of your lacking or say if you wanted it. And that's controversial to some people, but it's genuinely how I personally motivate myself when I am too tired and I don't want to get up and I don't want to push forward because it's the difference between getting up and making it happen to not. And I think within self-care culture as well, don't get me wrong, I'm all about looking after your emotional, physical and mental well-being. But they're also, I think, productivity and having a firm word with yourself is also self-care. Because if you look at that car and go, I want that, I'm going to make that happen and see it as inspiration rather than as a reason to go, put him down when you don't know him. Like you said, that's the difference in
mindset, it's just this minimization of wealth, even though all of us would love to win a lot of it. I think a lot of this stems back purely to jealousy. Mm-hmm. And again, that's conscious in most people and wasn't conscious in me, and stems back to a fact that actually in order to achieve that takes an unbelievable amount of effort, work, and if we're not prepared to do that, rather than owning that as a weakness in us, it's much easier to say, money doesn't matter to me, money's not important to me, I want to chase these things. And actually, it's if you really dissect that, is that really true? Because if I give you £1 million tomorrow, would you go to work Monday morning? No, you wouldn't. No. So your whole argument's blown apart. But again, to figure that out about yourself requires a huge level of, one, humility, and two, deep introspection, which, let's be honest, most people just don't have it. So.
Yeah. Would you say that natural curiosity and kind of self-awareness has come from being raised in quite a spiritual background and where you have to be aware of everyone within your community, because it isn't just about you, it's about the community that you're within?
Although actually within Mormonism, there isn't much, probably the same in most organized religions. And again, I didn't realize this whilst I was involved in it, but there's an awful lot of individuality of thought, because you're taught a certain set of presuppositions and principles and doctrines, and that's it, that's what you're taught. You don't get away from that. Mormonism is unique in as much as they claim to be the only true religion on the face of the earth. Catholics and Mormons are the only two religions that claim that. So they claim all the religions are wrong, and that is the only religion on the face of the earth. So in that way, you're almost kind of indoctrinated. There is no space to question anything. But it was my dad. My dad's a very unique and unusual man. And he exposed my brother and I to very kind of adult scenes really early on. So when we was kind of 7 and 8, 9, and we knew who Martin Luther King was and who Gandhi was, he would make us listen to Bob Dylan lyrics and then ask us what we thought the interpretation was. He made us learn the Henry VIII speech at the Battle of Agincourt so we could recite all of these things. So
he taught us encouraged to question and kind of have your own opinion on the world around you rather than just taking things for fact.
He taught us to think, which sounds very trite, but it's not, because people don't think. We don't think. Almost everybody acts completely on autonomy. We think that we think, but we don't. We think about what's the tea, we think about is the washing done. We don't actually think about who we are, where we're going, what do we believe in, why do we believe in that. Is it true or does this just feel good? So that's the greatest gift my father ever gave me was the ability to think critically.
Which is so important, I think, especially in modern day society where we're bombarded with opinions left, right and center because of social media. It's not, in the past, advertising was a lot more minimal. It was, just what you'd read in a paper here on the radio. Whereas nowadays we're bombarded with so much opinion and people aren't taking the time to actually research and back it up with facts rather than just blindly following, I guess.
Well, that's because now, we're not just bombarded with opinion. We're bombarded with opinion that masquerades as truth.
Yeah.
So you can't disagree with certain narratives without being labeled misogynist, homophobe, transphobe, bigot, and racist. So there's no exploration of truth anymore at all. Yeah. None, zero. You can't even have, an honest discussion with people. It's if you don't agree with this narrative, then we will shut you down. We will cancel you. We will get you sacked. That's happening everywhere. So
cancel culture and very polarized.
It's massive. It's massive. It's getting worse and worse. Which ironically is the beginnings of fascism. which kind of blew my mind that the Anti-Fascist League uses fascism to fight fascism is a huge irony. We're bombarded now, not so much like you said, with information where we can weigh and consider what we believe to be true. Facts are no longer relevant. All that matters in this culture is feelings. If you feel something is true, if you have a lived experience, nobody can question your lived experience. It doesn't matter if your lived experience contradicts the lived experience of millions of people, your lived experience is a person. You know, police now have task force where they can turn up at your house if you found a tweet offensive. It's like, well, how do we get to this point? And then who decides what's offensive and what's not offensive?
Yeah, you know? Where's the line of offense? Because obviously some things can be offensive, and you know, initially that's where the word offense comes from, because it insults someone. But like you said, there is a point where we have to we still need freedom of opinion and feelings and debate. And I think we've lost the ability to debate anymore. I think it's either I'm right, you're wrong, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's that Miss Trunchbull quote.
Yeah. And then, I mean, when you question any of these things, you know, whether it's the trans movement or whether it's Black Lives Matter or any of these things, if you question them in any way, I don't mean in a derogatory way, if you're just trying to get to the bottom of something.
To understand as well, I think.
Yeah, but you will quickly find, as I've found in conversations that I've had, is that most of the people that believe these things don't have the answers for why they believe them once you get past one or two questions. And once you get past one or two questions, then you're just labeled as misogynist, bigot, racist, blah, blah, blah. Which, obviously, once somebody's done that, it's done. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to come.
Yeah, the label's a brand, then.
It's like, you know, you offended. So what? Grow up. Like, grow the fuck up. That's the price you can pay for free speech. I mean, grow up. This idea that because you offended, the police turn up. I mean, it's insane. And I don't think people realize how dangerous this is. This is exactly how... You know, this is exactly how Hitler's Germany in the 30s started. This is exactly how the Soviet Union started. It started with this giving away, this slow giving away of our freedoms, you know, and now there's 2 million people that have signed a petition to make everybody on social media give their details away, blah, blah, blah. And it's all done under the guise of equality and justice and hate speech. We want to protect children. Yeah. We want to protect online bullies. It's all done under this guise of, no, trust us, we're here to protect you. It's like, you have no idea what you're asking for. You have no idea what you're asking for, and you have no idea where this leads, because people have such a poor understanding of history.
I guess in the attempt to please everyone, you please no one.
Yeah.
Right? You can't be, I think in modern day society, we're so afraid of failure and of being disliked. It's almost the likes, whether it be that little heart in the corner of Instagram or somebody liking it. Sometimes people don't like you and they don't have a reason for it. Then they can't articulate why, but they just don't. And that's the way it is. And you're not meant to be liked by everyone, because that enables you to grow. Because if you're not disliked or you're not faced with setbacks, then you're not able to grow, develop, and move forwards. If everything's always easy, if everything's always amicable, then you stay the same.
Yeah, well, not only that. I mean, if you're universally liked, that generally means that you have no character. It means you have no personality. It means you have no individuality. There's nothing unique about it. All the greatest men and women throughout history have been as hated in their time as they were revered. You know, it's the best that anyone can say about you is you're lovely. Then you're failing. You're failing, you know? Half the people love Gandhi, half the people hate him. Half the people love Malcolm X, half the people hate him. Even Muhammad Ali now, who was revered as a hero, and rightly so. People forget that in his time, 50% of Americans hated that guy.
Yeah, he was very controversial for his time.
Anytime you take an opinion, you're going to be hated. So if you're universally liked, it's the same as not being. It's the same as not existing. Yeah. You know, you're not existing. You haven't gone beyond your persona. There's no personality there.
Yeah. And you talk quite a lot, I've heard in interviews before, I find it really interesting about, you quite openly talk about the pursuit of truth. You use the word truth quite a lot, and honesty and being true to yourself. And I'd like to know a bit more about like what you mean by that, kind of how you try and carry that forward through things that you do in life.
So truth for me is, when I speak about that, I speak about what's true about you, what's true about me. And that's a journey that is incredibly painful. It's incredibly difficult to do. It requires a huge amount of humility, and which is the reason why most people never do that. Most people never get beyond the persona. That's why people dress the same, have the same opinion. And because once you do that, you quickly realize that, you know, as much as 95% of who you think you are is bullshit. It's bullshit. It's part of your parents, part of your culture, part of your society, fear of not wanting to offend, part of wanting to fit in. And then, you know, when you stop and go, whoa, hang on a minute, how much of this is actually me? Where's me? You know, and most people don't know who they are. But when you say that, it's incredibly patronizing. I understand that, you know, but if you go and read, you know, Jung or Nietzsche, these guys broke this down in such a brutal way, but it's very, very true, is that most people are just different versions of other people. You know, their lives are a meme, you know, their beliefs are a quotation. Most people are versions of other people. They have spent no time. This was me as well in my 20s, so I'm not in a lofty position. It's like they have spent no time figuring out who the fuck they are.
Yeah. You know? Your 20s especially is that. I think I'm 25 turning 26, and I feel like this is the prime identity crisis, in inverted commas, era, where everyone's going at different paces. Everyone's trajectory is very different. You know, some people are getting married. Some people have moved abroad. Some people are still at home, have never worked a job. Like, everyone's life is so different. And people start to panic because they then look externally to think, okay, what do I need to tick off? What's everyone else doing? Because in school, we're taught to tick off a set amount of things, right? And you leave school and nobody's telling you what to do anymore. And everyone's like, well, what now? What do I do now? And then I think that's where, like what you said, the dilemma comes up, in that it's easier to copy than, again, to fear to fail, to be disliked, to get things wrong.
Well, I mean, not even that. I think as well, that most people aren't even aware that there is something to discover within themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, our culture is so rigid, you know, you get to 18 and then you start to drink and then you go out on the weekend and then you get into fashion and you wear the same. I mean, you go on a Saturday night and every guy's wearing the same Gucci t-shirt. Most people aren't even aware that there is something to follow.
Yeah,
or something to find, rather. So they end up literally just following their culture blindly, without ever stopping to think about, what is this? Is this real? Where is my life going? What do I want out of this? You know, and it's a shame, because a lot of people, when they finally figure this out, you know, they wake up at 50, and they go, shit, I think I've just spent the last 30 years not finding out who I was, doing a job that I hated, or being in a marriage I didn't want to be in, or doing things I didn't want to do, you know. And that's the basis of most midlife crises. What midlife crisis is, it's like, oh shit, I thought I knew.
Here I am.
And I didn't know. And that's why, you know, you look at the people, most of the people that society reveres, they are the renegades, they're the outcasts, the anarchists, they're the people that said, no, fuck this, I'm not following this crowd. They realize very early on that all of that kind of structured, boundaries way in which we operate in the world is nonsense. It's nonsense, and nothing happens there. There is no good to be found there.
I found it interesting you said in an interview that we need like a balance of stoicism and courage. And I found that really interesting, in that the way you speak about weakness, I think your dialogue around weakness is very interesting, because I think in the 21st century, weakness is a very loaded word. It's one of those words that can be, if you describe someone as weak, that again goes back into what we were saying about being offensive. And I think the way that you reclaim words like coward, weakness, failure is very interesting, especially in the male space. Yeah. And I'd love to know your opinion on things like toxic masculinity and why you choose to use that kind of vocabulary, and as actually an empowerment tool rather than to put you down, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think toxic masculinity exists. It's nonsense. It's a nonsense, bullshit, made-up term. Now, you can argue all along where that term comes from. Mm-hmm. You know, feminist movement off the media. But I mean, there's definitely been, it was an extreme word, but there has definitely been a dumbing down, if you like, of traditional masculinity, you know, flustered. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's evident. That's clear.
Yeah.
And that all comes along with this encouragement of men to be more open to the tearing apart of traditional masculine roles. And when you do that, you eradicate any kind of truth that exists, and you put something in chaos, which is where masculinity is now. Masculinity is in chaos. And, you know, we hear all the time, I've been podcasting this before, where people talk about the suicide epidemic amongst men, and depression epidemic amongst men. Where does that come from? And it's the pressure of social media. It's like, no, it's not. It's not from any of those things. It's because we have built up a society that actively encourages weakness, you know? And for me, suicide is an act of weakness. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't have sympathy, you know, not in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't mean that I am dismissive of people's pain. You know, I've been suicidal. I've been in that place, because I understand what that's like. I do understand what it's like. But I think when we don't call things out for what they are, we can't ever fix them, you know? Yeah, I think what a dangerous thing to tell people, it's okay to be weak. Sometimes, no, it's not. It's not okay to be weak. You know that. If your knee is weak, you go to the doctor and get it fixed.
Yeah.
It's not okay to be weak, okay? It's okay to recognize that you are weak.
I was going to say, for clarification, just to the listeners, you're saying it's okay for you to be sad or to be in pain or to have a mental illness. There's nothing wrong with having that diagnosis, but the difference is not allowing that diagnosis to dictate your life and actually going, okay, this is a weakness I have that I'm struggling with. How can I reclaim it to get my strength back? And to
push absolutely. And I think, I disagree with the general narrative around mental health anyway. I think general, and this is from a person that worked in mental health.
Yeah.
Is that mental health has become something, in my opinion, especially in this society, which people use as a way of offsetting the responsibility they have to fix themselves. People want a diagnosis. It's like, well, I'm depressed, I'm anxious. Mm. Okay, we all are.
Yeah.
I mean, depression and anxiety, your birthright as a human being. Now, I understand that there are different levels to that. I understand them. And I understand that we don't all start from the same place. Some people go through hideous childhoods. Some people go through trauma. Some people live in bubbles and are very protected. But depression and anxiety are your birthright as a human being. And the answer to rectify that is not to attempt to appease people with prescriptions and with diagnoses. The answer to that is to try to get people stronger, because you can't make life easier. And when you give somebody a label, you know, it gives them a get out of jail free card. It's not me, I'm bipolar. It's not me, I'm depressed. Well, it's not me, I'm anxious. It's like, no, I get all of those things. I understand that, but you've now made it part of your identity.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, being anxious and depressed, you know, I'm someone that, if I allow myself, I'm quite a depressive person. I'm quite a dark person naturally, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I also realize that me being in that state doesn't serve me well. It doesn't serve my family well, my business, my community. It doesn't serve anything well. So I have to consciously fight being in that state. Mm. Whilst a lot of people, and I think this is just evident, self-evident, is just that diagnosis then becomes a part of who they are, their core being. It becomes part of their identity. And it's like, no, you can
do. And once you allow it to be a core pillar of who you are, the same as, like, I've got blonde hair, I am 5'6", then there's no removal from it. And it's very difficult, I find, the conversation around mental health. As somebody that was hospitalized with mental health, so I was hospitalized at 13 with an eating disorder because I was literally on death's door. If somebody didn't force me to eat, I was going to die. Mm. But I was poorly in an era where mental health wasn't discussed. It was very different. And it was seen as a weakness that I was ashamed of at the time. And I don't think you should be ashamed of mental health. But the reason I say that is because I used it to make me stronger. I didn't use it to enable me to stay where I was. Because if I did that, I would have never have lived my life. I would have still been in hospital in that cycle. And I think it's very difficult now, because I think it's important that there's the awareness of mental health and the discussion around it, and people have an understanding more so of what it is, rather than being like, who's that weirdo that went to hospital and we don't understand why, which is very much what I had at 13 when I'm having this like crisis anyway as a teenager, and you just want to be liked. To balance that out, I think there's no motivation or impetus to heal and to improve. And there's a weird conversation around it, in the sense that sometimes I do think you have to hit rock bottom in order to propel yourself up again. But I think it's very dangerous to sit in that rock bottom, like you said, and attach yourself to that label and stay there. And also, if you aren't, like you said, I think people casually use the word like an adjective now, like, rather than depression being, you know, a headache, I've got a headache. That's what depression is. It's a diagnosis. It's being used as an adjective. And I think that is...
That's a good way to describe it. And it's like, I'm 41 years old. So I've met a lot of people throughout my life. Mm-hmm. They all suffer from depression at some point.
Yeah.
Because, you know, guess what, people? Life is fucking hard. It's brutal. Finding out who you are is brutal. Raising a family is brutal. Trying to put, you know, money in the bank is brutal. Trying to get through the fucking day is brutal.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's one of the dangers of social media, is that we bought into this fantasy that somehow life is easy. And when things don't go our way, I'm losing to a depression. You know, this didn't happen with our grandfathers. This didn't happen, this sense of weakness. Yeah. And now we're in a place where those traditional masculine traits, you know, of stoicism, etc., are demonized. I mean, not just demonized. I mean, the American Psychological Society issued a paper last year that literally said that these things are damaging to young men. It blows my mind. You know, there is stoicism is, for me, the only way to live your life courageously. We shouldn't be teaching people that it's okay to be weak, that it's okay to be vulnerable, because it's not. It's not. It's selfish to be there. It's okay to be there for a moment. I've been there for a moment. Like you, you know, I was sectioned when I was in my late 20s. You know, so I understand it. Like, it's okay. Life is hard. And there are going to be things that come into your life that legitimately take you out of the game for a while.
Yeah, they knock you out and there's no kind of pre-warning.
I know people that have been depressed for 15, 20 years and taking pills for 15, 20 years. And then on it's like, fuck you, man. Like, seriously, like, you haven't even attempted to turn up into your own recovery. You haven't even attempted to do anything about it. So of course you're depressed. We're all depressed. We're all anxious. We're all nervous. We're all scared. We're all going to die. Everybody you know is going to die. You're going to experience far more failure than you do success. You're going to experience far more misery than you do happiness. So of course you're depressed. So the narrative should be, how do we make people stronger? And we've built a society that, on the surface of it seems noble, but we have taken love and compassion far too far. And you can love somebody to death. You can empathize with somebody to death. You know, love and compassion are amazing qualities. It should be the starting place for any therapeutic, you know, intervention, therapeutic relationship. But there has to come a point. There has to come a point when you take responsibility for who you are, you know? And that's why I'm not afraid to say, right, you need to man up now. Well, you need to man up because you have a wife, you have children, you have a family, you have responsibilities. Okay, it's time to man up. It's time to man up. It's time to take your responsibilities as a man seriously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this, we have built up a culture of weakness. And that's what we see all around us, you know? It's weakness. We are surrounded by weak people, especially weak men. You know, there was an act, I can't remember the name of the actor, but I saw a quote by him a few weeks ago. It was in reference to kind of the COVID pandemic, et cetera, the taking away of our freedom. Where he had just said, a generation of strong men would never have allowed this to happen. And that's why they attacked masculinity first. And that's why everything a guy does is toxic. No, and it's just, for me, it's just, not only is it wrong, it's deeply, deeply dangerous. You know, masculinity, real masculinity, is and has been throughout millennia absolutely essential to society.
What would you say that real masculinity is, in inverted commas?
I think real masculinity is many things, but I mean, you could sum it up under the banner of real masculinity is responsibility. And that sounds very simple, but how many people do you know that take general responsibility? I have responsibilities. I have children to raise. I have a business to run. Okay. My business doesn't stop if I wake up in the morning and sell the press. Take responsibility for who you are. Take responsibility for the things in your life that you can control, you know, and then build on your masculinity for that. Take your masculinity seriously. Like, it's an incredible thing to be a man. You know, we need men. We need strong men. We need brave men. We need noble men. We need men with integrity. We need men that aren't afraid to tell the truth, you know? Yeah. And that, for me, is the essence of masculinity. What do you stand for? How do you put your truth into the world? How much can you endure and keep going? How much pain can you endure and keep going? How much are you willing to sacrifice for those that you claim to love and keep going? You know, what principles do you stand for? How does that manifest itself into the world? That's masculinity.
I think that's very interesting, because I think the modern day definition, I would say, of masculinity is very different. It's almost like aggression, control, you know, stubbornness. And actually, like you said, that's not what it is at all. It's control, yes, but in the sense of taking responsibility, the strength, the consistency, the steadfastness. I always used to see, because I think in life you need a balance of both. You need that feminine energy, you need that nurturing, like you said, that love, that compassion, that softness, that gentleness. Yeah. But you also need, in order for that to free flow and not cause chaos and flood, like a river, say, you need the flow and the smooth flow of the river, but it needs to be dictated and guided by the steadfastness and the control of, like, say, a mountain or its surroundings. And I think, like you said, we tend to pivot one way or the other. We either go really heavy in the one end, in the masculinity, say, or we go really heavy in the femininity. And I think it is a very difficult balance.
It's also, there are elements of what you just said up as well that people would view as negative that are not negative. I mean, you do want a man to be in control. Most women want that as well. I don't mean control in the sense of a dominating relationship where you're controlled. I mean, you you want to be married to a man that takes charge of the household, that takes charge of leading the family? Of course you do. Do you want to be a man that's capable of aggression when it's appropriate? Of course you do. Do you want to be with a man who, when if you're in a bar and trouble starts, he can protect you? Of course you do. Do you want to be with a man who, if you're, you know, you're asleep next to your husband and your children in bed, you know? Do you want to be with a man that has the courage to go downstairs and to take? Of course you do. These things are essential to masculinity. They have been throughout millennia. Mm. These are not bad things. You know, it's what Jordan Peterson spoke about, which I find so fascinating. And for me, it's an inarguable concept. He said that a good man, look, a good man is not a good man by default. Yeah. And we believe we are. You are not good by default. Okay.
You have to work at it.
What you actually do. If you ask almost anybody if you're a good person, they would say yes. And then if you do a little bit deeper and ask them why, they would simply give you a list of things they don't do. Well, if your goodness is defined by the fact that you don't rape, steal, murder, that's not a good man. And actually, a good man, what John Peterson said, you know, a good man is a monster that has that under voluntary control. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's exactly what a good man is. How can you be a good man if you're not capable of being an evil man? Because then what are you defining your goodness against?
Yeah. Darkness and the lightness. So you're not saying that a good man is somebody that's done the rape, steal, murder. You mean somebody that knows that those are choices, but they choose not to do them.
Yeah. Look, everything has its opposites. Okay. So we don't want to talk about everything has its opposites. Okay. And all of us have got dark thoughts that we would be about to share. You know, whether they're dark thoughts about harm or dark sexual fantasies, whatever it may be. And it's like, right, the two hardest parts of an individual to integrate into their character is their sexuality and their aggression, which is why 75% of the prison population are in prison for violence or sexual violence, because those two things are incredibly difficult. Those two things are incredibly difficult to integrate. You know?
Do you think that's because it's a very animalistic quality? Because obviously sexual nature, that's still a very kind of an animalistic urge and desire. And then aggression is quite fiery and explosive. It comes out of nowhere. It's not a more gradual emotion, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and because those two things are usually, I mean, talking specifically about men, those two things are usually executed so immaturely, so poorly, you know, which is why you get a lot of guys that will come and chat to you in a bar and be creepy about it, or you get a lot of guys that will just engage in violence because somebody looked at them the wrong way up on Sean's brain. So the older you get, the more you realize, actually, do you know what? I'm capable of violence. I'm capable of misogyny. I'm capable of being a creep. I don't want to be those things. Those things don't serve me well. How do I bring those things under my voluntary control? Not how do I eradicate those things?
Yeah, it's not about removing it. It's about being aware, like being self-aware, choosing to control it and maintaining that.
And using it for good, because I mean, look, these archetypes of masculinity. I mean, if you look at Batman was a womanizer. You know?
Very much so.
He was a womanizing capitalist who was able to harness that and his powers for good. The Incredible Hulk was somebody that used his anger in a way that was absolutely catastrophic for himself until he met the right woman, and then he was able to harness that anger and use it as a force for good against the bad guys. You know, we often look at this so wrongly. I mean, you look at the people that fought in World War II that we rightly call heroes. Yeah. They did horrific things. They did horrific things because you have to do horrific things in war. So you need men that are capable of doing that when the time is right. The problem that we have here is that we have such an immature culture, is that we don't teach young men especially that there is a time and a place for your anger. There is a time and a place for your violence. Mm. You know, there was a time and a place to explore your sexuality. That's why S&M clubs exist. 50 Shades of Grey, the best-selling book of all time.
Yeah.
It's essentially about bondage and rape. But it's fine because the guy's a billionaire. You know, 50 million women bought that book.
That's so, very but, interesting.
So to pretend that women don't have these fantasies too about that type of man is nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, and to pretend that, you know, I don't want to be protected by a man is nonsense. Yeah. You know, it's getting the balance right, you know. And I think that's what I do. So I would consider myself an excellent father. I do nothing but shower my children with love and affection. And I don't look for problems ever. I don't want problems. I want peace. You know? At this stage of my life, I just want peace. But if trouble was to come my way, if people were to threaten my family or those I love, then I'm ready to do what is necessary to protect the people that I love. And for me, that's a trait of masculinity. You know, it's not just being able to hit a guy in a bar because he bumped shoulders. That's a child. That's not a man.
It's how the qualities are used, isn't it? And I think because what we're seeing of like typical masculine traits now is, like you said, very immature, very uncontrolled, very riotous in ways, where then the whole essence of being a man is then negated and put down, when actually there are some really important elements of being a man and having that masculinity that balances out the femininity within everyone. Like, a woman has masculine and feminine traits, a man has masculine and feminine traits, and it's that balance of the softness and the strength, and neither are bad. I find nowadays it's, you have in a similar way, women are now having to be strong all the time and having to be tough and provide for themselves and, you know, not need anyone and be alone. And actually, like, yes, I'm a feminist and that I believe in women's voices and being self-sufficient and having equal space and equal pay. But at the same time, I also do recognize the importance of having a partner that is equal in that playing field. And actually there is, you know, when you have children and things, there is that subconscious nature of wanting somebody else there to help you and provide for you whilst you then do that role for somebody else that needs to.
I think you used the word equal, and that's, you know, it's a respective thing. Men and women are not equal, and I've always not equal. We do different things, you know, and what that does is when you meet someone you engage in a romantic relationship with, that person, right, is that your differences create something that's magical, you know? I don't want somebody equal to me. I want somebody that's better than me in certain ways, you know?
That makes sense.
And I was better than them in certain ways. You know, this idea of equality as well, we brought into this myth of equality. We're not equal. We're not all equal. We're all different. We're all very, very different. And we shouldn't be treated equally, you know? You bring your own worth to the table, and that's different to mine. I bring my worth to the table, and that's different to yours.
Yeah.
And hopefully those two things combine to create something that's special, you know?
Yeah.
And for me, that's the way that it should work. But I think this constant march, and you mentioned that you were a feminist. I don't know to what degree you're a feminist, but it's... Mm-hmm. For me, it's the removal of that masculine essence, which actually I don't believe is something that most women want to see eradicate.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it was the guy in just last year where there's like 7% of UK women identify as a feminist. And and it's not that women don't deserve equal voice. Of course.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying, is that you don't mean that we don't deserve to do the same roles or to get paid the same or have the same rights. What you mean is that it shouldn't be the removal of one thing or another. And I think it is very difficult, actually, and I will totally agree with that, in that it's dangerous to use words like feminist, because actually, am I a feminist in the most polarized extreme version of the word? No. I want to be appreciated as a woman in my femininity, my softness and my gentleness? Yes. But do I also want to be treated with respect and embrace my inner strength and the masculine qualities of myself? Yes. And that's, I think, people who explore feminism are aiming towards, is they want the equality of the masculine and feminine essences, but not. But I think, again, it's one of those situations where it's been taken polarized and it's about the removal of one thing or the other, and that's not the case.
Yeah, it is. You know, and like the equal, I mean, you mentioned equal pay then. I don't know if you get onto that, because I disagree with that. But it's for me, it's not about looking for... So I don't believe in equality in the traditional sense of the word, but I think nature endows us all with very different things. So the idea that we are equal is nonsense. The idea that we're of equal worth is human beings is nonsense. The idea that we're all worthy of love is nonsense. The idea that we're all worthy of respect is nonsense. These are myths that we're bought into. These are things that you earn by the virtue of the way in which you conduct yourself in the world, you know? And if everybody is deserving of these things, then you devalue them. They become worthless by definition. Like for me, so I'm single, so I'm very independent. I drop my own company. I actively seek out my own solitude. I'm very happy to be in my own space. Doesn't mean that I don't sometimes go, be nice to go to bed with somebody, be nice to lay down with somebody. Well, both of those elements are there. It just means that I intend to not have those things, you know?
Yeah.
And actively in my life, like if a woman was to come into my life, they would have to be a strong woman, because that's what I admire. That's what I want. I want a strong woman, you know? Mm-hmm. I will always be the leader in my household or in my relationship, because I feel that's a man's role to do. But that doesn't mean I want to be with a weak woman. I want to be with a woman where I wake up on a Monday and go, fuck, I better get my shit together. She's overtaking. I want to be with someone that I can be in awe with and be inspired by, you know?
Yeah, someone that runs alongside you and propels you forward rather than interjects your kind of path. And
yeah, and I think what feminism has done, I mean, this is probably a generalization, but it's...
Mm-hmm. I think what we're talking about is extreme yes. versions yes. of yes. situations,
that's
right?
That's the only version, unfortunately, that's perpetuated by the media, is it?
Yeah.
You know, agreed. Women want equality and we don't need a man. It's like, well, actually, no, you do need a man, and men need a woman, and that's what we were created for. And actually being in love with a man and meeting someone that's the love of your life will add to your happiness incalculably. You know, a man being in love with a woman will add to his happiness incalculably. You know, this idea that we should teach independence over everything, like, it's just dangerous. Happiness isn't found there. Be independent, because at some point in life, you will need to be, right? Yeah. And independence is courage and ability and bravery and all those things. And you should do that, because you're going to need those traits.
Yeah.
You weren't born for that.
We weren't meant to be alone. It's not as Nate. There's, I mean, I don't know any animals in the animal kingdom that are designed to be solo, really. It's, you know, we're all at some point designed to need a companion. And I think that's, you know, that's where true growth and development happens. And I think that's where the weakness comes in, and that people think it's weak to lean on others or to allow others in to fit that jigsaw piece together. And actually that's true strength, because when you bring one person's strengths and weaknesses and another person's strengths and weaknesses together, they can complement each other to then build it all into a strength.
Yeah. And I think it's the lies that we tell ourselves about the character traits that we think we don't want. Mm-hmm. And men and women do that as well. So, I mean, you will get mad, but for me, that will slut shame. You're watching porn every night. You sound to girls only fine. It's like, no.
Yeah.
You do want a slut. Just marry a girl that's just slut for you. It's okay to have fantasies. You know, and we don't speak. It's like, women, I don't need a man, and this is misogyny. 50 Shades of Grey was the best-selling book of all time. Explain that one to them.
Yeah.
They're hardwired into us. Like, you could be a strong, independent woman, which is what you should be, and still actually want a guy to take control from time to time. If that's hardwired into us.
Yeah. But
we've kind of been taught this narrative, both of us, male and female, that actually we, in order to be true to our genders, is that we have to pretend we don't want these things. You know, and it's like, actually, no, a part of us does want these things, and that's okay. It's okay to admit that. You just got to find the proper place for it. That's all. You know, that's what S&M is. That's what bondage is. These are places where people can go that have dark fantasies. Go, okay, I realize I have these dark fantasies. Mm. Should I eradicate that? No, because that's what leads to rape. That's what leads to people acting out against. It's like, okay, so what should I do with this, with these dark fantasies? Well, okay, well, here's an S&M club. Go and explore. Go do it in a safe place. You know? But we're not mature enough as a society to talk about sex and sexuality, you know, in a mature and considered way. We're just not. They're things that still embarrass us. We still have that Victorian Christian hangover when we talk about these things.
Did you find that are you still Christian? I didn't actually ask you that question.
No, Zach, no. So I'm not. I actually, bizarrely, with everything going on in the world at the moment, and I haven't felt this since I left Mormonism, so I've felt a kind of real strong pull back to, not religion, but I don't believe in organized religion, but I felt a real strong pull back to God, or, you know, whatever that may be, you know.
Yeah, when I was God in Mormonism, can be many things.
Yeah, so when I was in Mormonism was very prescriptive, as all religions are. So this is what God is. This is what God looks like. This is what his plan is. This is what he does. This is very sensitive. So now I go, no, I do believe in God. I've just stopped claiming to know exactly what that means.
Yeah.
Like, when I look at my children, or when I'm feeling sad, or when I cheesily look, when it rains, or whenever I'm feeling nostalgic, I can feel that there is something transcendent. There is a transcendent principle in the world. And I don't know what that is, but I live my life according to that transcendent principle.
Yeah, it's like a higher, I think there's many names for it. Like in the spiritual sector, a lot of people call it the universe, you know, energy. There's lots of names for it. And I think it's just that external instinct, guidance, force, whatever you'd like to call it, that gives us that greater purpose, direction, and sense of self, I guess.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's what a lot of it is. But for me, I've not felt that for 15 years. But I mean, recently I've kind of felt that desire to return to, I don't know what it is anymore, but to return into something that's transcendent.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we all need to live by something in our life, whether it's God or spirituality, that is transcendent. Otherwise, what's the purpose? If they're not looking for transcendence, what are we looking for?
Do you think that's one of the biggest problems with modern day society is lack of purpose?
Oh yeah, definitely. That people don't have purpose. People don't have meaning. Because in order to find purpose and meaning, you have to know who you are. You have to explore yourself. You have to face brutal truths about who you are. You have to come to the conclusion that a huge part of you is overwhelmingly nihilistic and awful and nasty and deal with that. Mm. And people don't want to do that. So there is no meaning and purpose. But the meaning and purpose of most people's lives is to live paycheck to paycheck, you know, and that's for everybody. You know, I'm talking about even people that have six-figure salaries.
Yeah.
That there is no purpose there. It's just a mere existence. Some people exist nicer than other people.
Yeah.
It's just their existence. Most weeks are indistinguishable to any other week of that year. That eventually, in my experience, catches up with most people at some point.
Yeah.
At some point, it catches up with them because they all have that moment. You know, I've just seen it in my father's eyes. You know, that when it's like, what is this for? You know, that's the great play by Arthur Miller, Death of the Salesman, which is exactly what that was about. You know, this guy had given his entire life to this company and worked hard and made the millions. And, you know, when he retired, you look back up at the building and just, it was at that point it hit him at 60 years old. They had given his entire life for nothing. And that's tragic because when you're 60, it's game over for you. Another lie we tell each other, it's never too late. No, it is too late. What life provides us with very tiny windows of opportunity in which to do something. You know, hesitation kills dreams more than anything else. And there comes a time in your life when it's too late. Too late. So you better figure out who the fuck you are as soon as you possibly can. And you'll get it wrong. You'll get it wrong. Without a doubt, you'll get it wrong. And you'll take three steps that way and go, oh, no, that's not quite right. We'll have to go back. And three steps that way, well, that's not quite right. But as long as you're attempting to figure out who you are, you know, by the time you hit your 30s and your 40s, you'll become somebody that's formidable and somebody that people want to speak to. And you'll become someone that has a voice in the world and somebody that's respectable and somebody that people will listen to. No, rather than just somebody that can name you fucking Kim Kardashian's kids and wears a Gucci t-shirt.
I think that's definitely a very convoluted idea of what purpose and success is. I find it's very much about this idea of perfection or this illusion that we create online, especially. Mm-hmm. Everyone's trying to get to attain that rather than, like you said, trying to attain a true idea of who you are, what your principles are, what you stand for. That I think there's I always find it very interesting if there's any other time, like times of conflict or disagreement, and you'll have the two polar opposites of the opinion, somebody that thinks one thing, somebody that thinks the other. And then you have the people that are silent in the middle, but that's still a choice. That's still standing for something. And I think we're very much in all three areas of this opinion. And where I was going with that was that I think focused so much nowadays on creating an illusion of who we want to be, that we actually don't know, one, why we're doing that, and two, who the person is behind it.
Yeah, no, absolutely, it's true. And I mean, and social media is the bedrock of all of that. I mean, when you break social media down, you know, I don't have any personal social media. When you really break down the psychology of social media, it's one of the most fucked up things on the face of the earth. Like, it genuinely, genuinely is. I mean, the psychology that goes behind it. You know, this is part of the, you know, with the feminization of masculinity. I see grown men that will take pictures of their food before they eat it. It's like, break that down. You sat in a restaurant, you've ordered your food, you're opposite your girlfriend, presumably your friend. You've had to get that phone out of your pocket, you've had to slide it open, you've had to open an app, open the camera thing, take a picture, make sure it's right, apply a filter, then press send, then write a comment. It's like, what the fuck? Like, what a and for what? So people you've never met know you're eating steak, you know? And guys that do, whose Instagrams are selfie after selfie after selfie, like, I don't need to speak to you. I know everything about you already. I know everything about you already. We don't need to have a conversation. And it's such a perverse psychology, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's led, without a doubt, to the weakness of this generation. I don't need to know who the fuck I am because 3,000 people are going to click on my picture. And it's dangerous. It's beyond that. It's evil. I honestly believe that social media is a form of societal evil. And it hasn't manifested itself quite yet, but it will. I think in 10 or 15 years, it's going to manifest itself.
I notice it a lot in my industry already, and that if you have a higher social media following, you're more likely to be seen for a job. If you fit more within the standards of what social media applauds and encourages, you're more likely to be seen for a job, you're more likely to be cast for something. And that's, I think, very scary because it's no longer about the talent that comes into the room, but it's about the number of likes you get on a photograph. And actually, that photograph isn't indicative of what that person is, what they offer to the table. It's just a photograph. Again, like we said before about the fear of failure, the fear of mistakes, the fear of weakness as well, that is fed in with social media. It's a very bizarre, I can say this because I do it as a job, I utilize it as a tool. And it is wrong. It is fucked up because as like somebody who uses it to create leverage for companies and brands, you basically manipulate the weaknesses of the user in order to create profit. That is what you do.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I get it. I mean, there are many things in our culture that we would rather not engage in, but yeah, we have the choice to engage in.
Yeah.
So the question is, okay, how can I engage with this thing that I deeply disagree with to the smallest possible amount? And I was like, okay, I had a business. I attract new customers via that account. I'd rather that I didn't. I'd rather there was another way, you know, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, you can be a creator, not a consumer. And yeah, I think that's the ultimate, I think the difference that I had to find is that I'm not going on social media to consume, unless it's content and opinions and unless it's like diversifying my awareness of the world, or I'm learning a skill, or I'm surrounding myself with people I wouldn't normally be exposed to, because for me, I use social media to diversify my surroundings, because otherwise I'm surrounded by the same people with the same opinions. And I don't want that, because I want to have an understanding of all opinions so that I can debate and that I can understand and that I can broaden basically my perspective of the world. But yeah, I think the biggest, somebody said it to me the other day and it's just stuck with me, is be a creator, not a consumer.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. But even social media has fed into this kind of weakness epidemic, to the point now where, yeah, obviously you can hide the amount of likes you've got.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Like, what? Sorry, what? We want to protect people. Is that we are just encouraging weakness? We need to protect these people, because if they don't get enough likes, they might feel sad. Well, how about we tell these people to go the fuck up? How about we engage as a society, probably start an education system that teaches a sense of mental agility and mental toughness that we don't have. But we don't have to hide likes from people. You know, this is insane. And then the other thing is, was the biggest reason I got rid of my social media, is that we are now living in a situation, and this is going to get a lot worse, believe me, where social media companies, the big four social media companies, are now the arbiters of free speech. Mm-hmm. That's it. And do you want to be complicit in that? I don't want to be complicit in that. Part of my decision to remove myself from these platforms as a personal individual rather than as a business was just to say, if you get to a point where you recognize there are things in your culture that are disastrous, that are going down the wrong path, then you have a moral obligation to act. You have a moral obligation to do something about it, because otherwise you're complicit. There's no way around it. You know, will you delete your Instagram account, change the world? No. But would it mean you can look yourself in the mirror at 3 a.m? Yes. Mm-hmm. There's a great quote by Dostoevsky, the great Russian novelist, who was, he exposed the gulags in the Soviet Union and the workers' camps of the communism. And he was an idealist to begin with. So he believed that he could change things. We all do when we're younger. We can believe we're going to change the world.
Yeah, you want to change. So, I mean, it's even me now. Like, I'm still young. I'm 25. But, like, you know, my aim even with this podcast is to make a difference, because I want to try and improve the environment and the world that I'm in.
Yeah. So making a difference is great, but we can't change the world. So what Dostoevsky did, so when he was in the gulags and then in these prison camps in Soviet Russia, he realized that he couldn't change the world, and that things were going to happen no matter what. And actually that his voice was one voice amongst 10 million, and it didn't matter. And one of the most beautiful quotes I've ever heard that he said was, "Let the light live, even let it prosper, but not through me." You know, I was like, that's what a beautiful thing to say. He says, "Let the light live, let it prosper, but not through me." You know, I will not have blood on my hands for that. People don't even realize what's going on because they don't do the research.
Yeah.
And two, and this is the really difficult thing, right? Because to become an individual, like a genuine individual, and to develop a sense of genuine integrity comes with a huge amount of sacrifice. And that's why we don't do it. Freedom, real freedom, is scary as fuck, because it comes with a huge amount of sacrifice. And it's like, you may have to get rid of something. You might have to pay a price for your opinion. Yeah. You may have to
step away from the pillars that build the foundations that you know.
Yeah. And it's like, if you claim to believe something, then you better show me some fucking evidence that you claim to believe. Otherwise, you're just noise. You're just noise. You're not an individual. There are consequences to belief. There are consequences to integrity. There are consequences to becoming an individual. There are consequences to that, very real consequences. But there is nothing in this world that is more powerful and more beautiful than an individual who knows they are and owns themselves and is willing to take the consequences of being who they believe they are. And we just don't do that. So, you know, I would encourage anyone to say, how complicit do you want to be in this culture? How complicit are you?
It's very difficult, isn't it? Because I think it is a very difficult balance in trying to, like you said, be an individual, but then also battle that need for the greater good, I guess, if that makes sense. Because you don't want that individuality to be at the expense of others, if that makes sense.
No, you do. Look, everything you do will be at the expense of others. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I used to think very much the way I should be using now is like, okay, I want to go about the world. I want to do as much good as I can, hence why I chose the career that I chose. I want to tread as carefully as possible, and I want to do as much good as possible without causing as little damage as I possibly can.
Yeah.
And you can do that in certain settings and for a certain amount of time. If you do that for too long, you're no longer an individual. You know, if a plane's crashing, what's the first thing they tell you to do? You put on your own gas mask first before you help anybody out. Even if you're a parent, you put yours on first before you even help your child. But why do they tell you to do that? You can't help anybody if you're in the same position as them. Your individuality comes at a price. It comes at a price.
Yeah, that's very true, actually.
And that isn't because...
You're not going out of your way to hurt people or to cause harm.
It's a consequence of your journey. A consequence of me holding the thing I hold is that some people are offended by them. Now, do I want you to be offended? No. Am I attempting to offend people? No. Am I attempting to be provocative? Absolutely not. I have no interest in that. Mm-hmm. But if you happen to find what I say offensive, that's not enough to stop me speaking my truth.
Yeah.
You know? So you pursuing your individuality by default has to come at the expense of other people. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, then you'll be too afraid to become an individual. You see? And then you'll be too afraid to speak out because you want to stay there. Well, I wouldn't say this thought in this company because that would upset that person. And then it's like, now you're back to being a persona. You're back to being an individual. The thing that people don't realize, especially young people, is that there is a price to pay for being an individual. There is a price to pay for living your life with integrity. There is a price to pay for living your life with meaning. And you cannot change the world. Greater men and women than me, you've tried it for centuries. You cannot change the world. But what you can do is change you. If you can change you, you can change those that are the closest to you. And then step by step by step, maybe over the course of 100 years, you change the world. And what is the world? You're the center of the universe.
It's an accumulation of... It's interesting because I'm doing a yoga teacher training at the moment, and there's a phrase dropped around a lot called "you're a little drop of God." And it's really controversial in a way, because the way some people will perceive that is like, well, that's awful, that's blasphemous, X, Y, Z. But actually, I think what that means that is that all of us collectively are drops of what makes up the world, right? Mm. And so like you said with that, with what you just said, in that if you can change who you are, then you're changing your immediate circle, you're changing the people that precede you, and then that accumulative effect will have a greater impact than just trying to force an opinion on someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people attempt to do that. It's virtue signal. It's a sense of offsetting your personal responsibility to fix yourself, to align yourself to a group so you can feel as if you're part of a worthy cause. And the reality is, what do we mean when we say we want to change the world? Well, you don't live in the same world that I live in.
Yeah.
You're in very different worlds. But you can change the world, but it's your world.
Yeah.
You want to change your world.
Yeah.
I change my world. And if you do it with integrity, you end up with many different worlds that are all operating on a similar level of understanding. But the only way that you can ever change anything in this world is by changing who you are. Because nobody gives a fuck what you say. You realize that, though, yet nobody gives two fucks what you say. Imagine people don't care what I say. They care what you do. Well, they care what you do, you know?
Yeah, actions speak louder than words.
Yeah, because you get to a point where it's like, I'm no longer going to listen to the advice of somebody whose life doesn't manifest that advice, you know? So how do you change the world? Be a better person. You, just you. Well, there are plenty of problems within your own personal purview that you can fix and that you can heal, and that when you do that, you made the world a better place.
And what would be your advice for someone that is wanting to take action and take responsibility for themselves, specifically men in this situation, because we talk about masculinity quite a lot? What would be, you know, because I guess in a way that there is that fear of healing, isn't there? It's easier to sit in the space of just being rather than to take the action and do what's hard in order to heal and move forward. So what would be your advice to do that?
You have to find a commitment to truth about who you are. You have to take yourself into unbelievably dark and uncomfortable places and admit things about you that you don't want to admit. Mm-hmm. And our mind is very clever and the world is very clever at actively preventing us from admitting those things. And the only way that you can ever improve as anybody, but especially as a man, is to be brutally honest with who you are. Be brutally honest with your flaws. Are you really honest? Are you really telling the truth? Mm-hmm. Are you really all in on being a father? You know, are you really all in on being a wife, a husband? Fuck no. I could be a better dad. Mm. Who wants to admit that? Who wants to admit that the biggest role in your life you could be better at? And that's me. I could be a better dad. It's like, fuck, I could be a better Jesus. I don't want to admit that. unless you admit it, then you can't be a better dad. And everybody around you suffers, you know? Yeah. And that, this is why we have so many weak men. It's because in order to become a strong man, you must first identify what is wrong with you. And nobody wants to admit what's wrong with them, because agony to do that. We don't want to admit that we have these kind of flaws. We constantly want to present ourselves as being better than we are. So break yourself down. You know, it was Jordan Peterson who said that he had done a similar in his mid-20s when he had begun to kind of semi-consciously listen to himself speaking. Yeah. And he realized that 95% of everything he was saying just wasn't true. Either he was trying to say it to an argument, or he didn't really believe it, or he was trying to be polite in a certain company, and it bothered him. This isn't who I am. Yeah. And he went away and did this journey of self-discovery, and he was like, I realized that 95% of me was bullshit. 95% of me had to go. And he's like, that's terrifying. What's left? 5%. This little 5% of us. He's like, but if what's left, that 5% is strong and noble and courageous and righteous and has a desire to be more than you currently are, then that 5% becomes stronger than the 95% that you just burn away. Yeah. You know? So it's a difficult lesson for people to learn.
It's like when people are in relationships and they give up their whole identity and they almost become the person they're dating. Yeah. And then when the relationship ends, they're left with this kind of shell of a person, really, that they've neglected for so long. Yeah. And then they're like, well, who am I without this person? And I guess that's almost, you know, like an analogy for what you just said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a clip, I'm going to send it to him, Dumbies, somebody had asked him a Q&A, look, how do you get to know yourself? And the first words out of his mouth were, you get to know yourself, you first have to admit that you don't. That's deeply offensive to most people. How dare you tell me that in a while? Say, no. If I ask you who you are, I know what you're going to say. You're going to give me your name. You're going to give me your age. You're going to give me your occupation, where you were born, what parents you do. Those things are arbitrary.
All this surface levels.
Yeah. It's like, to get to know who you are, you first have to accept that you don't. That's your starting point. But to get even to that starting point requires a level of humility that I just don't think most people are capable of.
It's quite painful to get to that point, I think. And a lot of people that I've met that are even trying to access that point, it's only because they've faced very, very shitty lives or really bad. They're old souls on young shoulders in the sense that they've probably had to face a lot more than most. And that's almost what brings a humility in, not by choice, but because life forced it on them.
Yeah, it's been a catalyst. And because now there is this, I mean, why would you embark on such a dangerous and difficult and heartbreaking journey when there are so many places to hide? Why would you do that when you can go out on a weekend and have casual sex, and you can take recreational drugs, and you can watch Love Island, and you can go shopping, and you can live for the weekend? Why would you do that? We live in a society that is filled with white lights and pretty things and distractions that literally keep you from ever trying to identify who the fuck you actually are. You know, we've built a culture where you can spend your entire life hiding. You can spend your entire life doing nothing in this culture, and nobody will question you. Nobody will call you out. And then you wonder why there's a generation of men that wake up at 50 years old and all of a sudden feel suicidal.
Because there's no purpose or identity.
No purpose, no identity, no driving force, nothing that's transcendent. It's transcendent. You need a transcendent principle in our lives, you know? And actually, that's the point where you become an adult. That's a sign of maturity. Mm. And once you figure out that transcendent purpose, whatever it may be, I mean, for most people, it's children, but it could be anything.
Yeah.
With which you don't really become an adult until there is something in your life that you care about more than the weakest parts of you.
When you have to kind of clutch that strength out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I think that would make sense why children is it for so many people, because that little human depends on you. You can't give a toss about yourself anymore or your weaknesses or what you're good and bad at, because nothing can prepare you to be a parent. You don't have a clue until that child appears and then you've got to just figure it out.
At that point, your depression doesn't matter. Your anxiety doesn't matter. Like, stuff has to be done. And it's at that point that that's when you become an adult. That's when you become mature. It doesn't have to be children. It could be anything. But until you have something in your life that is more meaningful than your weakest moments, you will just go from crisis to crisis till death, and interspersed with some drugs and some casual sex and a few good nights out. That will essentially be your life.
The kind of, it's almost like we're concealing it. We're getting the concealer and just dabbing it.
I'm engaged in all of those things. There's a place for those things. But people build their lives around those things. They build their lives around those things, you know? And it's not good. It's not good for anybody. It's not good for you as an individual. It's not good for your family. It's not good for your society. It's not good. it's not good. We had too many places to hide in this culture.
And on that note, that actually moves very smoothly into my question of what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
You know what, I was told lots of things when I was younger, but they were all kind of applicable to religion, which now I look back as an older man are not applicable at all.
Yeah.
So I thought it was great advice at 16.
Yeah.
Right advice at 40. But I think, so I know I mentioned Jordan Peterson a lot, but I discovered him like 5 or 6 years ago before he became as popular as he is
now. Yeah.
And Ed said about the need for men to find out who they are, to take responsibility for their action. That's the best advice that anybody has ever given me. And it's the best advice that anybody can ever receive. And it seems so trivial. Because like, what's the best advice you ever had? And, you know, and people want to hear some profound statement. It's like, you know what? There is nothing more profound in your life than taking responsibility for it. There is nothing you can do with your life that is more profound than finding out who you are and living that into the world. There is nothing more profound you can do. What else are you going to do? You're going to party from now until death? There is nothing more profound you can do with your life than to say, I am going to find out who I really am. And when you do that, you become somebody who's really formidable.
That makes me think of a famous quote that says, be who you are because everyone else is already taken.
Yeah.
And it's a lot, it's a more kind of flamboyant way of saying it, but it is true in that be who you are because you are the only version of you. There isn't anyone else.
No, fuck everybody else. And it's like, if you have a difference of opinion, speak on it. If you have a truth inside you that you can't share, share it. You know, learn to be brave, learn to be courageous, learn to be disliked, have the courage to be disliked.
Yeah.
You know, and understand that there is a price you pay for individuality. And that's why this society has so few individuals. When was the last time you met somebody that's a genuine individual? And maybe every 5 years I meet somebody that holds my attention for 5 minutes. When was the last time you met somebody that could articulately express an opinion? Rare.
Yeah.
So rare, you know? It's like the most profound thing you can do with your existence is to discover who you are. You know, you look at a 70 or 80 year old man in the face who is filled with regret. You can see how much aged them, and they're haunted by those ghosts, their demons of what they didn't do when they were young men. There's nothing in the world more tragic than regret, especially when there's no time to reverse it. And there's nothing more redemptive on the face of the earth than truth. It redeems people. Truth redeems people. So go and find out what is true about you, no matter how hideous that may be, then fix it. There is nothing more profound you can do with your life. And you don't have anything better to do.
I think we decorate it and we add things to the actual core purpose of being here and existing. And actually, like you said, it's a lot simpler than we make it. I think we overcomplicate life sometimes.
Definitely. And it's nice. I've got to go to work. I've got to build a business. I've got to build money. Mm. Nice to have a nice car. It's nice to have money in your pocket. It's nice to be able to go out and buy a nice dress, a nice suit, a nice pair of trainers. Go for a nice meal. These things are nice. Don't get me wrong. I'm not any of that. Don't let those things define you.
Yeah.
People do.
For those that want to know more about you and your business, this is your chance to self-plug anywhere for them to find you.
Yeah, on Instagram, it's just King Kobe Official. I mean, it's pretty dull. Many pictures of haircuts and stuff. But it's I've done other podcasts. I did a few podcasts with The Guardian. So if you can check out that on YouTube, if you just put my name into YouTube, I think they're the first things that pop up. They talk deeper about some of the things that you and I have spoken about. So you check them out if you're interested in anything else that I have to say.
And what's the bigger vision for the man behind King Kobe?
I want to be done. I've got 3 years tops and I'm done. So the idea now is to have really doubled down on the next 3 years are all about making as much money as I possibly can. And then out and just to be as quiet and as peaceful as possible and to raise my children and to be out of the madness that is this world.
Out of the hamster wheel.
Yeah. It's not a place for me.
Well, thank you so much. It's genuine. Well, you've been a real pleasure to talk to you. You have a very good way of articulating yourself and it's very inspirational. And I think the trajectory you've taken in life is a very interesting one.
Thank you.
For sure.
Thank you. It's been good.
To stay in the know on Jeans and a Nice Top podcast, follow us on Instagram at Jeans and a Nice Top Pod and make sure to hit that follow and subscribe button for the latest drops and guest reveals. Thank you so much for listening and I'll catch you on next week's episode, Podletters.
This has been an I Am Listening exclusive podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.